From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in November when a Wall Street regulator launched a probe into credit card practices at Goldman Sachs. The probe was sparked after a tech entrepreneur and his wife each applied independently for an Apple card. When each was approved for the card, the husband was awarded 20 times the credit limit that his wife was, even though they filed joint tax returns and the wife had a better credit score. The couple alleged the Goldman Sachs algorithm was discriminating against women. And the case highlights concerns about inherent bias in so-called black box algorithms. Around the same time the probe against Goldman Sachs was launched, a different probe was opened against United Health Group after evidence showed an algorithm favored white patients over black patients. As artificial intelligence, or AI, continues to advance, the scientific community is grappling with questions about fairness. How can we ensure AI is fed good data that achieves and even promotes fair outcomes? Evidence shows AI has the potential to create more equitable housing solutions, even with finding placement for refugees and people in the homeless population. So how can humans best capitalize on this technology in ethical ways? This hour, our guests explore if and how AI can help us become a more fair society. It's a continuation of a previous conversation about AI with local journalists and researchers, among others, including Matt Kelly, who's an independent journalist who has us thinking about this. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Ehsan Haque, who is the Asaro Bigger Family Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Rochester. Professor Haque, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Welcome back to Hadi Hosseini, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at RIT. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And welcome to Jonathan Harrington. John is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of Rochester. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
When we talk about fairness, this is perhaps not the first word that comes up, Matt, when we think about AI, but it's pretty easy to, I think, understand it, because for me, initially, I thought, well, I don't know where we're going with this, but it was much easier to understand it when I looked at stories like this, because it's, for me, what it boils down to is if we're not careful, we're going to create machine learning and AI that is either sexist, racist, classist. I mean, it's very possible to do that, and I guess we're already seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the stories you highlighted in the top of the hour really emphasize that point, and I think, you know, any technology, and I put this out here as a question to our group as well, but any technology is going to reflect the bias of its creators. I mean, and that's what we need to start thinking about, because AI as a technology has the power to do some really good things and also has the power to do some really poor things. In either direction, AI is going to change how humans interact with their world. If machines are able to start essentially thinking on their own, we are going to be co-creating technology as we move ahead. There's a book by an author named Flynn Coleman. She wrote a book called A Human Algorithm. And in her opening, she kind of points out that we are, as humans, as creators of tools, we are on the cusp of creating tools all on our own. We're going to be co-creators moving forward because of the AI that we're creating. Could it be good? Could it be bad? It can be whatever we want it to be. But I think that's knowing the power that this technological advancement has for our species and our future means we have to be very attentive to the baked-in bias.
Well, let's ask everybody, and I'm going to start with the lecture in philosophy. Professor Harrington, when you think about AI, what are the appropriate kinds of questions to ensure as much fairness as possible in our society? Because it's not like we're having this conversation before AI gets up and starts running. I mean, it's already happening. But to Matt's point, it's going to become more and more sort of opaque, probably for us as a general society to understand, let alone the scientists and the researchers who create it. What are the questions that need to be asked here?
Well, I think there are a couple of like fundamental questions that need to be asked first. And they're really like deeply philosophical questions about what we think fairness really means or is. You know, traditionally, we might think that fairness in making decisions is about how we make the decisions, what kinds of things we consider. In the context of race or sex, we might say it's not a fair decision if we considered someone's sex or we considered their race. We need to be colorblind or sex blind. But there are other definitions of fairness that might take into account not just the process by which we make the decision, but also the AI makes the decision, but also the outcomes that the AI or the decision produces. And those kinds of outcome or distributive fairness questions can be very complex, very quickly. And so it's a matter of us thinking very carefully about exactly what we mean by fairness, and figuring out also who are the people who get to decide what account of fairness we ought to encode into these machines.
When we look at stories like Goldman Sachs, for example, and we think about what Matt is raising with the people who are creating certain technologies, those technologies might reflect certain biases, whether people are aware of it or not. Do you view the concerns that you have about AI, are you concerned more about sort of sort of inherent but accidental bias being transferred over to machine learning and this technology, or something more malicious? What are your biggest concerns?
I think the computer science community and the developers of AI have been very aware for a very long time and very concerned to limit the kind of malicious use of their programs. There's been a lot of effort to try and eliminate sex and race from data sets that are used in the formulation of these machines and programs. But I think the real risk is this kind of unintentional bias where the machine takes what looks like a fair data set that doesn't include race or sex, but it produces unfair outcomes. It produces unequal rates of error. It produces unequal distribution or decisions about who's going to get a loan and who's not going to get a loan. Those are the real kind of thorny questions, these unintentional biases that might arise.
Hadi, when you look at the question of fairness in AI, what stands out first to you when it comes to the sort of the possible concerns and the possible benefits? And how are we doing? What's sort of the report card so far?
Yeah, I would like to first go back and draw a connection with one of the questions that we discussed last time. And that was really about how AI has surprised its inventors. If you remember going back to that session, and one of the things that we didn't get to discuss is that the surprise and the surprise of AI has been mostly through what we learned about ourselves as a society. And that's really not what AI did. That's what we did when we started processing a large, massive amount of data, and then started realizing that the data that we're using to make decisions about who gets to live in different affordable houses, or who gets this credit card, or what type of credit they're going to get, all these decisions are based on the data that we fed into the algorithms. And this was something that was probably implicitly known, but it was never made explicit for the whole society as a whole and in the public eye. So the question here is that really what we are doing is, how can we ensure that the data that is getting in is going to be clean data, is going to be something that cannot have these type of biases within itself. So we have a kind of like a famous saying among computer scientists, think you have this garbage in, garbage out. So if you just throw garbage inside the algorithm, definitely the outcome of it is not going to be a good outcome. I also want to make distinction between two discussions that you mentioned in the opening. I think there is a difference between fairness in AI and fairness through AI. Mm-hmm. So these are different things. So what we are discussing right now is really about ensuring fairness when we're using AI algorithms. There is another discussion that, if we have time today, we're going to get into, which about using AI in order to achieve fairness. And fairness could be fairness in terms of allocating scarce resources among the people. For instance, talk about affordable housing. Talked about how AI has been helping with the refugee settlement et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's an important distinction. And just one other point before I turn to Professor Hawk. When you think about the reasons that this process may end up having, I guess, what we would call negative or adverse outcomes, is it, I don't want to say it's simple, but is the most important first step to making sure, to Matt's point, the people creating this reflect society better than just sort of a concentrated group of mostly white creators or mostly men or whatever the case may be? Does the representation in the creation of whether it's algorithms or technology, how important is that in this process?
Absolutely important. I think it's very important to have different views. And not because the process is going to change. I think what happens is that having more diverse set of people with diverse ideas, diverse experiences, they would be able to look at different things in different ways. Something that maybe it's not very visible to me and I don't see any problem that might kind of raise a red flag for a student of mine who might come from a completely different culture or background.
Okay. You want to add to that before we grab Asa on there, Matt?
Yeah, just very quickly. I think also by having people from diverse backgrounds also opens up a whole landscape of possibilities for how we can apply AI as opposed to just sort of a narrow set of tasks that we could put them to.
Okay. Professor Hawk, how do you view the question of fairness in AI? What stands out as either a concern or an opportunity?
So the first application that you mentioned in the beginning, like financial system decisions, job interviews, or even payroll system, those are the applications where AI has a potential to do maximum harm because those decisions are critical. But if you look at how humans make those decisions, they're also very bias prone. There are studies done where they took the same resume. In some cases, they changed the name to white sounding names. In some cases, they made it African American sounding names. And when they sent it out for jobs, guess what happened? The white sounding names received 50% more callbacks. Similar studies were done in payroll system where they looked into judge's decision. And they found that right after having a meal, judge provides a favorable decision. So this is the state of the art what humans are doing. Like, we have the objective data. We are inserting our own bias in addition to the bias that already exists in the data. So if you use AI, actually we eliminate the bias that human inserts and we deal with the data that we have. And it's fair to say that, yes, AI will amplify the bias that exists in the data set, and there are ways to put checks and balance.
Well, I've got a phone call from Rich I want to get to, which I think touches on this. Before I do that, one quick question each for John and Matt here, because I think, Matt, I'm fine with sort of being known as kind of a sky is falling person with AI, because I don't mind when AI decides it's going to turn us all into paperclips. And, you know, society breaks down. I'll be the guy who said, told you so, and then I'll be paperclips. I guess my view is I think we ought to have every conversation, no matter sort of how fantastical or extreme, to make sure as much as we can before it happens, knowing realistically we're probably not going to stop certain things. But one of the concerns I have is sort of going back to our last conversation. If we get machine learning to be so advanced that it is difficult for the average member of the population to understand it, let alone the creators. And then you start having some of these adverse outcomes, what appears to be unfair, or people who feel like, you know, for example, the state of Michigan has acknowledged that at least 20,000 Michigan residents, possibly as many as 40,000, were wrongly accused of unemployment fraud between 2013 and 2015 by a $47 million state computer system that the state operated without human supervision. You get more stuff like that. But people don't feel like, number one, they can understand what went wrong, and they don't feel like there's going to be recourse if they either get wrongly accused or they don't get an outcome that is fair. My concern is the more advanced and complex this is, the harder it's going to be to fight it when the outcomes are bad. Is that a sky is falling view, or do you share that concern?
No, I think that's a very legitimate concern. I think one of the things we're facing with artificial intelligence and technology written large as we're creating it now, not just AI, is this idea that it's advancing so quickly that humans don't have time to even understand it and literally adapt to it. I mean, research shows that the human hand evolved along with tool creation. As we created tools, certain hands did better with them, so they created more tools. back and forth, back and forth. Even with something like the printing press, which I know in its day was the AI of, you know, like the 1400s, the world's going to end, everybody can read now, print is available to everybody. There were still centuries, decades that allowed humans to get used to this. We're now having the potential to create machines that can create new machines in a matter of, I don't know, seconds, days?
That's actually a really interesting point. I mean, just about every major technological innovation for many decades and centuries in the world had some time for adaptation. The speed of this is pretty remarkable.
I think what's most frightening to me is if you look back at, I think it was the 2018 congressional hearings with senators questioning Facebook executives, and just the appalling lack of understanding, like congressional hearings to be like, how do I share this with my friend? It's like, it's not what we're here
for,
Senator.
That's more a commentary on who we're electing.
Well, yes and no. I mean, things are moving so fast and there are so many details to understand. Who can understand them all? And so I think, you know, part of the ongoing conversation that we have here, that we have in society at large is, and that plays into the issue of fairness, is how are we preparing all of our community to be prepared for this, not just the rich kids at the rich school that have access to the big companies with money who are doing all of this.
Yeah, and so last question before I grab a couple phone calls, for John Harrington, a professor of philosophy, a lecturer in philosophy, I don't want to promote or demote you. John,
that'd be a significant promotion.
Is it just an academic question, or is there an actual utility to the question of whether we should slow this down and have these conversations? Or again, is that sort of too optimistic? Because if this team doesn't do it, this team over here will do it.
Yeah, I think we're right to point out that, you know, people don't just want to be subject to decisions that don't have any kind of justification or can't be readily explained to them in terms that they can understand. I mean, I think that's a really kind of fundamental principle of what it means to be a citizen in a society, is to have someone be able to explain to you why you were treated in the way that you were by the state or a company or whatever. And I think the bright spot in all of this is that the computer science community has been relatively attentive to this problem with machine learning. They've tried to start exploring the idea of what they call explainability, which is making sure that the algorithms are, that we're able to explain the decisions that these black box algorithms make to people. Whether or not you ought to slow down the production of these machines is one question. Another is whether you can.
Probably can't. You agree with that?
I think that's probably true, although that's more of a question for the computer science.
Well, let me get Rich in Rochester first. A couple people have been waiting with, I think, some really interesting points. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Good.
I work in the computer industry, and I read about this stuff all the time. And my biggest concern is, like, looking at the financial piece, talking about loans and things like that, or any sort of decisions. When they speak about data, a lot of this data will be historical data, which is blatantly and patently sometimes racist or sexist. Even in, say, for instance, the prices of houses, if we look at the historical data, houses in this area were cheaper or whatever, for whatever reasons may be in place. What can you do to alleviate those issues? I mean, like, example, in farming, like, white farms are always better than black farms, but people forget the fact that white farmers got all of the government assistance when black farmers didn't. So you have these built-in biases and built-in institutions and structures. My issue is, and my greatest fear is, that this stratification will become greater because these algorithms will be written that are so efficient based on bad historical data, it will just accelerate and make this worse. And how do you alleviate that and all of this type of stuff, even from loans to everything, anything that you can think of when it comes to the human condition? I don't know if we're ready to do this.
Rich, thank you. Let me kick it to Professor Hosseini and Professor Hawk on that, because if we have this ideal that we're going to do a good job of creating AI that's going to create the most fair outcomes, Rich is pointing out, you know, if it's using historical data that have biases already built into them, we don't always have the fairest history. What are we going to do to sort of deal with all of these complexities? I'll start with Professor Hosseini.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And this is exactly what I was referring to like previously as like garbage in, garbage out, because you have this data, this historical data. You cannot not use it. And at the same time, if you use it, there are some biases inside the data. Now, the interesting part is that there has been the problem is really by itself very, very challenging problem, in the sense that even if you remove the identifying type of identifying information from the data, just think about like removing the name, removing even the ethnicity, or removing the race, removing the gender, you still have these problems showing up, because interestingly, there was this because it's been shown that in many systems, these algorithms actually can pick up based on other identifying information. So even if you remove, for instance, the features of about like race or gender, then based on the location of your house, based on where you went to school, based on all that information, it is possible to infer infer your gender with really good high probability. It's possible to infer your race with a very high probability. So it's a very, very challenging question. The good news here is that the AI community, computer scientists, are very aware of this. And they have started working on this for the past several years. So they're now trying to design algorithms, design systems that takes this data as input. But before the algorithm actually even starts to give you an output, it internally tries to figure out whether the output is going to be a biased output or not, by creating some sort of hypothetical situations. So hypothetically, we'll try to kind of change what's part of your data and see whether this is going to be affecting the final result. So that's the good news. But are we there yet? No.
Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
I just want to jump in real quick just to say, I think to me what Hadi just pointed out is one of the most fascinating things and why we need to be having this conversation about AI. The benefit of AI is that it can see things that humans can't. I mean, for lack of a better term, right? It can just see things that we can't. The dangerous part is even when we remove all those things we think will show a certain bias, the AI can still see things that humans can't.
Great. maybe great. I don't know. See, I always sound like the downer when it comes to AI. I'm also really appreciative of the opportunities it presents. I don't know. Maybe John Harrington will disabuse me of my optimism before the end of the hour. Professor Hawk, what do you make of Rich's call, which I thought made some really important observations?
Data always contain bias. And that's why in our decisions, we put forward different kind of checks, like affirmative action to fix things. So it's really difficult for algorithms to take on the same data and be able to have a decision that's 100% unbiased. I just don't think it's possible. One good thing about algorithms, as Matt pointed out, they're objective, they're standardized, they're repeatable. So when I feed in some data and when you get some output back, I can go back and understand, why did I receive this output? How do I, if it seems incorrect, biased, how do I fix this? So again, the decision is on humans to be able to take the output and add your own reasoning to it to make it more appropriate for today's world.
Let me read an email that, hey, calls out the host of this program for something that I think is perfectly relevant to what we're talking about. Annette says, I just tuned in. Sorry, but I can't listen to a show where all the talking heads are male. Come on. Annette, I own that. I will say this. We are very sensitive when we book programs when it comes to representation. We hope that the audience understands that sometimes there are cancellations and sometimes there are difficulties booking guests from different backgrounds. Let me read from the Harvard Business Review about this issue, because the Harvard Business Review says, to ensure that there's no gender discrimination that comes from AI, which apparently we've already seen in some cases, There needs to be a way to ensure women are at the table when it comes to developing AI, and they write the following. Consider that women's current representation in jobs related to AI is unequivocally poor. According to 2018 data from the World Economic Forum and LinkedIn, only 22% of jobs in AI are held by women, with even fewer holding the most senior roles. This is an important disparity because those who learn about, experiment with, and implement AI technologies will be creating the tools that organizations use on a day-to-day basis, and any unconscious biases baked into their decisions they could make have serious consequences, end quote. So can we, I think you used the term affirmative action, but can we use some kind of regulation or rule to ensure women are at the table, to ensure people of color at the table, to ensure there is socioeconomic diversity? I mean, can those precautions be taken, Professor?
Absolutely. I think we seem to anthropomorphize AI, but at the end, it's just tools, and humans are building them. And I think there are sciences moving forward. Maybe in the 10 years, we can educate the developers about the bias in the data and how do you really fix it. So at the end, we'll end with intentions. And when you have that, perhaps putting regulations, motives will be the heart of the conversation.
Go ahead, Professor.
Just want to jump in very quickly, say that it's very important to have like guidelines and rules and say what to do, what not to do, just like affirmative action. But I don't think these are sufficient. I think we all need to realize that we need to become enablers in the society. We need to enable younger girls to go to school and to study AI, to be interested in AI, in computer science, and STEM fields. And this is something that's lacking, because sometimes I think politicians think that, hey, let's just put affirmative action, problem solved. Guess what? It's not solving all the problems. We need to start like going to schools. You start from even like elementary schools and then go up to colleges and try to enable these people of different background. It's not just gender inequality. It's also like different types of inequality. We have race inequality in AI as well. We need to start like enabling people to be able to go and educate and get to their level. And then we are going to get to a close to a society where we can easily say that this is a very good, diverse society.
I mean, I frankly, John, I think we should have ethicists in the room with all of these teams. What do you think?
I agree. And I just like to point out that the best, I think, ethics of artificial intelligence work that's being done at the moment is being done by a cadre of feminist and critical race scholars, folks like Kate Crawford and Deborah Hellman, a law professor at the University of Virginia, are really leading the way when if we're thinking about the kind of these issues about fairness in AI. And I think, you know, it's not just important to have diversity with respect to the computer science developers, but it's also important to have diversity with respect to the kind of sociologists and lawyers and the people looking at the ethics of AI to ensure that all the kinds of perspectives are being covered and all the kinds of potential problems are being uncovered.
And I completely agree with that, because I think in 10 years, it's no longer going to be a technology problem. It's going to be a societal problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we may not be that far away. And again, you know, Matt, you shared a lot of sort of background material here. Ray Kurzweil is someone who's prominently known in the field. He's with Google now, I think, but, you know, has been writing for a long time about this. And whether it's Elon Musk or Kurzweil or others, I mean, they talk about us being half a century to a century away from becoming, you know, sort of hooked into the clouds ourselves as human beings. That speaks very strongly to your point about how fast this is moving and how little time we're going to have to adjust when some of the bigger advancements actually cascade upon us here. That makes me a little nervous.
What really makes me nervous about it is the fact that those changes are going to be made among a certain class of people. We already see a huge wealth disparity in the world, where capital sits with a very small percentage of people. Suddenly you're going to add technological advances to that. I mean, stratification is not a word that we should throw around lately here. I mean, that we're talking about very serious, baked-in, hard-to-move stratification that can occur if we allow these things to happen. I think one of the most one of the many interesting things about having this conversation goes back to something that Hadi said at the beginning, which is, and I don't know if you intended it this way, but it's this idea that by working on AI, we've actually come to understand how biased our databases are. And we may not have done that before unless we were grappling with these questions. I hate to say it, maybe AI pointed that out to us. And so I think AI, both as a thing, but also as this process and conversation we're having, has the potential for us to revisit who we are as humans and as societies as well, because we are forcing ourselves to ask these questions about basic fairness. What does fairness mean? And I love the distinction between fairness of the data, but also fairness of output, right? Because we would say, you know, to be fair, you don't have to consider race or gender or any of those things. But you know what? Maybe it's the output we should be looking at. And that's really fascinating. I should say one of the solutions that has really intrigued me for dealing with the baked-in bias, the perhaps eternal bias for any technology or database, is this idea of, you know, as AI rolls out in these sort of commercial packages and things that we have available to us, should we put something like a warning label on it, something like a nutritional label that says, you know, here's what this AI is, here's the sort of inherent bias, this is what we know, and it's some sort of standardized label that just goes on all of these packages so that whoever's using it, we just kind of know, like we admit it, we put it up front, here's where the 2.0 currently is, the 3.0 is going to look a little different, but we just hang it out there. We just make people aware that, yeah, this is what you're getting with this package, just be aware of it.
It's going to move so fast. I don't know if you can convince people to adopt standards fast enough. I don't know how you force standards in a very competitive industry. And by the way, after our only break of the hour, I will ask our guests where they see optimism and how they think we may see AI contribute to more fairness. I will take the time to sort of point out to a caller from the last hour who said that I never admit when I'm wrong. I'm wrong all the time. And here's a good example. I'm using AI today, probably, to have Spotify generate a playlist for me. I don't think there's like a John Spotify who's like, Evan likes these songs, so he might like these songs. I think that's AI, right, guys? And so where I say I'm wrong is I ought to be paying for those artists more. I'm not a big fan of downloading music and not paying for it because those artists deserved my money. Michaela Davis, you got my money in a CD. I also have a Spotify list. So if I listen to Michaela Davis and it goes through the whole list, but it keeps going, AI and Spotify will kick in and say, well, you didn't download these songs, Evan, but here's some stuff you might like. And a lot of the times I'm like, wow, you're right, AI. Good stuff there. I dig this. So for me, that's sort of a little benefit. That's interesting. But we're going to get much deeper and talk about fairness. Where can we make society better, more egalitarian, more opportunities, as opposed to some of the problems we've seen? Our guests are going to hit that on the other side of this break. Matt Kelly is an independent journalist. Ehsan Haque is the Asaro Bigger Family Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Rochester. Also at the University of Rochester is Lecturer of Philosophy Jonathan Harrington. And Hadi Hosseini is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Computer Science at RIT. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Elizabeth Wurtzel has passed away at the age of 52. She was the author of Prozac Nation, a 1990s book that sort of shook up the scene when it came to understanding depression and how we medicate and how we approach depression. We talk about the impact of Prozac Nation and how we're understanding medications and more on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So if I sound like the fly in the AI ointment, I'm trying to find all of the ways that AI is going to make society better. And Professor, Lecturer Jonathan Harrington, I am happy to promote you. I think your work is outstanding. But John, as someone who is constantly talking up the benefits of AI, or maybe not, do you find optimism? Do you look at avenues of where AI is going to make society or could make society fairer, more equal, more opportunities?
I mean, I think that's definitely possible. The big benefit of AI is the capacity to target resources where they're really going to do the most good. you know, we can think about the historical disparities in health outcomes between blacks and whites in the United States. Those disparities are in part because of systemic racism, but they're also because resources have been kind of poorly targeted in the past. And AI, machine learning, gives us an opportunity to really kind of predict where those resources are going to do the most good. Now, of course, I have an asterisk that is attached to that claim, which is that it really matters how you construct the machine learning algorithm, what things you target, what the data looks like that you put in, and kind of how you, the kind of social context in which you deploy that algorithm.
Okay. Professor Hosseini, give me some optimism on this.
So I'm a positive person when it comes to AI. Obviously, I'm an AI researcher, so that I'm already biased. But I think AI has already changed our lives in a very significant way. For instance, we are now using AI to basically decide who gets to study in top colleges. We do that to figure out who gets to live in affordable houses, or which nurses get to work in different shifts, in good shifts or bad shifts or whatever they want to call it. We're using AI like to ensure security at LAX and JFK. Through techniques that come from AI and game theory, we use AI to distribute like food from charitable organization to home shelters. There are many examples that nowadays that we're using AI to make good and fair decisions, to distribute the scarce resources among the people, to make sure that decisions are optimized and optimize for the people. So these are the decisions. And there are many researchers working on this. So I am very positive. In fact, contrary to what everyone is saying, that AI is moving too fast, I think it's actually moving too slow. And in fact, we are in a very slower slope. Like, it's going to even move faster than that, hopefully. But I think AI has brought a lot of positivity and a lot of good things in our life.
And so to clarify for me, the reason you want it to move more quickly is because you see the benefits, but try to enumerate one or two that don't exist yet that you can see within reach then.
There are many things that we are still not doing it well. So that's actually one of the problems. So we have started looking at AI solutions, right? So kind of going back to the self-driving cars, that's one of the kind of areas that we are almost there, but we are not there yet. And that will help us eliminate lots of crashes, lots of accidents, right? So that's going to help us as a society to have a healthier society. We have AI helping with decisions on how to make food and how to make sure that we are all living a healthy life. So there are many aspects of AI that we're still not there. And I don't want to even like talk about like AI helping us finding other resources in other planets. And I know that's becoming a little bit like more of fiction, but that's exactly where we are.
I don't necessarily find that to be fictitious.
We've already talked about paperclips. You're fine.
Yeah, we're all going to be paperclips, man. We're going to need those resources.
Exactly.
On Alpha Centauri. Okay, go ahead.
So I'm going to answer this question with a specific example. I've loved listening to Evan Dawson's show because I think Evan has a really nice vocal cadence. He's able to enunciate every word very clearly. He knows how to engage a panelist, somebody who is quiet. He knows how to delegate the turn to back to him. These are great human skills. Now, if we want to be as good as Evan, how do I do that? Is there anything that's out there that can help me to sharpen some of those human skills? I know one of my students and I attended a workshop. It's about public speaking workshop in New York City, and it was around $3,000 fee just to attend one. So it's talking about inequality. I think there is an emerging field within AI that's about helping people sharpen their human skills so that we all could become as good as Evan down the road. So I think that's the kind of optimism I'm excited about.
Oh, good. So AI is going to take my job.
I'm happy with that.
No, that's interesting. So the improvement of just human skills through AI, through machine learning, but you know, pick maybe a different category of sort of human skills, how is AI specifically going to be able to help us with that?
Imagine, let me give you one other example. Imagine if somebody's diagnosed with autism, who has difficulty inserting themselves in a conversation, or who doesn't know how to end a conversation, how to ask reciprocal questions, take interest. There's a branch of AI that's there that can help them with some of the conversation skills and help them be better. So imagine AI that can remove disability in this world. So we all can be equal in terms of how we talk, how we make connections, how we build relationships with each other.
Okay, Matt Kelly.
It's a fascinating answer to me because it really goes back to, again, our previous conversation, which is this idea of, is AI a tool that helps humans do things better, or is it a tool that replaces us in certain processes? And I think what Ehsan just described is a beautiful way of thinking about how AI can help us do things better as humans, that help include us more than we may already be in the process of things. I guess what I'm most hopeful about with AI is, I think there's general agreement that our world is only going to become faster paced, more data driven, more information. And if we think about tools as these things that improve innate human skills, humans innately try to sort through data and create patterns, right? But we may be at a point where we need a tool to help us do this in this world that is becoming faster paced, more data driven, faster, 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 faster. You know, maybe we really have sort of maxed out our human capability and we need to develop a tool that can help us keep pace, ironically, with the society, with the culture, with the environment that we're creating, which might beg to slow it down a little bit, but I'll just presume it keeps speeding up.
Well, do you share Professor Hosseini's desire to see it move even more quickly, Matt?
I don't go one way or the other on this, actually. I just want to be thoughtful about it. I want to make sure that we do it right, because I think, not to take us back to a dark note here, but if we don't get this right out of the gate, there may be no going back. I mean, this literally may not be a genie we can put back in the bottle. If AI starts moving so quickly and becomes so embedded and too many people start relying on it too heavily, we get to a point where people don't know how to, you know, live differently. And how do you take that back?
Well, go ahead, Professor.
But we are already at that point. Would you go anywhere without your cell phone? To check your email, to listen to music, to find where to go, like using maps. So we are already there. I think the issue that we are trying to resolve here is just to ensure that while we are getting there, we are aware of its dangers and we are aware of ethics that is behind AI and how we make decisions and be able to actually correct ourselves. And that's one of the good things about this whole movement. At least, okay, I cannot say whole movement, but partially it's being driven by researchers and scientists, because what we are good at really is to question ourselves, like, continuously. We develop something, an algorithm, the next step we figure out what's wrong with it, and that's exactly how academic world works. So I think we should just continue doing that, and in fact, try to focus on are different aspects of AI and how what technology brings to us a little bit more.
I'm going to do a yes and on this because I agree with everything you're saying. However, going back to the original question of whether
You're doing a yes, but go ahead.
Yes, but whether or not I would leave my home without my smartphone is a cyclical question, right? Because the reason my smartphone has so much value to me, both as an individual, as a journalist, as a professional, is because of the world we've created around the smartphone, right? So it's this kind of chicken and the egg thing, you know? If we had approached the smartphone and communication a little differently, would I really need a smartphone as we know it now? But because we've created the smartphone as we know it now, I kind of need that or the next best technology to stay afloat in that world.
I don't know. The smartphones came out in, what, 07? I mean, I was anchoring morning news at the time, and I calmly predicted that, look, people want phones to be phones. The last thing we want is a computer in our pocket, which I should be absolutely paid as an investor. I'm very, very smart with trends. But I was wrong on that one. And but Matt, at the time, we hadn't restructured our lives around it. We saw the potential of it. It comes out. And a few of us go, oh, that's pretty good. And then a few more people see our friends using it. And then it sort of became something as we saw its possibility. So the chicken and the egg, the egg was the smartphone. It became the chicken that the society wanted to use all the time because we saw the benefits of it. It wasn't thrust upon us. I think we chose it, didn't we?
I'm not suggesting anything is thrust upon us. I want to be very clear in any of these conversations about human agency, right? Like, we can make choices.
I actually find your defense of human agency really heartening, because it always feels like when we have these conversations, we can't stop this. This is a cascading wave and it's going to be upon us. You defend human agency more than most people when it comes to AI.
Well, but I don't think the two are exclusive, and I want to be clear about that as well. I think that if we are going to do anything moving forward, it's preserving the human experience. It is not to remove it. It is not to abrogate it. It is not to destroy it. It's not to presume that it's a bad thing that needs to be replaced. I don't know. I don't have a better way of saying it. I think being human is one of the most wonderful things in the world. I'll take the good with the bad.
So let me read an email that I'm going to read it exactly as Bob wrote it, and maybe our guests, who are clearly at a higher intellectual plane than I am, will be able to weigh in. Bob says, "Evan, please ask your panelists and listeners to step back and consider that AI, regardless of identified biases, may actually be cementing our current world and hamper outlier thoughts that we have that could drive humanity forward." I think what Bob is saying, if I'm reading it right, is that if we let AI sort of take control of a lot of the decision-making processes, that we are going to hamper human creativity and we're going to let the machines be the creative ones. And all of the different ideas and human dreams of creation that we could have that go outside machine learning will be limited because of all the emphasis on AI. Jonathan, do you share that concern?
In the near term, no. I think the real benefit of machine learning as it currently exists is that it eliminates a lot of kind of mundane tasks, kind of basic computational tasks that no one wants to do, and frees up human beings to think in ways that they're really good at. They're really good at being creative. We're really good at thinking in ways that don't follow simple principles or rules. But I think, you know, with that, as AI advances, there is this risk that we start to neglect particular parts of our lives. We start to not pause to reflect upon the choices that we're being nudged towards, or the choices that are being kind of made for us, in inverted commas, by the artificial intelligence. And I think that's the real kind of longer term risk, that these choices that are being made for us by the algorithms become part of our routine without us having made a conscious decision to make that our routine.
And let me read from Edward. "Are your guests familiar with the Compass algorithm created by the North Point Corporation and the 2015 ProPublica study of its use in Dade County, Florida criminal courts to determine bail eligibility? ProPublica found an unintentional racial bias. New York State Department of Corrections began using Compass in 2012 to determine the supervision level of parolees. Compass level is considered when making the decision to issue a parole violation warrant. I don't know if New York State DOCCS has ever acknowledged the question of racial bias." As a researcher, are you aware of that case, for example?
Yeah. So so the Compass was basically a system, I think, built by a private company, and that will help. I mean, it's supposed to be helping judges to make decisions, like parole decisions in case of parole decisions and some other decisions as well. And if you remember, like I mentioned, that sometimes just removing the very easy like identifiers of the data is not enough. Mm-hmm. And that was exactly the case with Compass. And that's exactly where I was thinking about and why I talked about this. So the idea here is that even if you remove some of the features that are kind of very explicit, you still are able to, these algorithms are still able to pick up based on some other features that are available out there.
Let me just jump in and say, the fact that you're discussing these kind of cases at length as a researcher yourself indicates to me that I should be a little bit more optimistic, that the AI community is very serious about this. Even when it's a challenge to sort of overcome where the bias may, It sounds to me like this community is very serious about this.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of work done since the ProPublica study. Mm-hmm. Just to give an example, people argue that imagine in a hospital, it's say 60% of the doctors who are male are really good doctors, and the remaining female doctors are also good. From that number, you could argue that male doctors by default are really good because the majority of them are good, and that leads to bias. So a lot of work has done into calibrating it. When you have the data, how do you calibrate it for the bias that may lead to the decision? So it's a great study, and I'm glad for the listener to bring it up. And a lot of work has been done on this.
Yeah, Hadi?
Yeah, just want to assure you a little bit more. This case of Compass is actually one of the very prime cases that in academic conferences, in academic talks, people start using this as an interesting case study and what happened. And so since then, there's a lot of groups that have been working on improving and trying to figure out what the issues are, even though I believe the algorithms are not publicly available, but they have been able to use it as a black box and try to figure out the biases and the problems with the system.
That's great. As we close this hour, I'll tell our listeners, we're going to continue to have conversations about AI and the future of AI, what we understand about it now and where it's going. We always seek to have diverse panels and women. I mean, I know there's comparatively few women in the research side of things, but we're going to keep working at that because that's part of our responsibility too. So I appreciate that email from Annette. And our thanks to Professors Ehsan Haq, Hadi Hosseini. Thank you for being here. We appreciate your time and your expertise. We appreciate Jonathan Harrington, a lecturer of philosophy at the University of Rochester. Thanks for being here. And our thanks to Matt Kelly, an independent journalist. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Matt's getting ready to spend the afternoon having a cup of coffee and updating his consciousness to the cloud. I'm Evan Dawson. Rob Braden is the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. Our thanks as well to the great team of volunteers we have. I can't see everybody back there, but hey, wherever you are, have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.